1 month on the run. How has Brian Laundrie managed to stay one step ahead of the law? This as lookalikes are being captured by marshals. One of them dragged from his hotel at gunpoint. And this many days as a fugitive, how is Brian Laundrie's mental stamina? Meet a man who spent 2 years looking over his shoulder, facing 20 years in the slammer. Plus, a side of General Colin Powell you may never have seen. The sweeter side of America's top soldier, dead today at 84. That's tonight on Banfield. Welcome to Banfield. 1 month into the manhunt and not a single trace of Brian Laundrie. How is that possible? How? Especially since his face has been plastered across every TV set across the country day after day. It led to a lookalike being cuffed and dragged out of his hotel while on a break from hiking the Appalachian Trail. And it also led to questions when police and cameras showed up this morning at a trail entrance in Connecticut. Meanwhile, the protesters, they are not letting up at the little yellow bungalow where the Laundrie parents live. And now Brian's father is facing a lawsuit, all because those protesters might just be getting under his skin. I am joined now by News Nation's Brian Enten, who's outside that home. There was a lot of activity there this weekend, Brian, and it actually led to police activity, which has led to a lawsuit. So take us back to the weekend and who showed up and what they did.
Yeah, on Saturday, Ashley, there were several protesters who showed up out here. They brought more signs. Let me show you, because the sign count has really increased since I last saw you on Friday. Right here on the swell, you can see there's another sign here. What if it was Cassie? A no justice, no peace sign. This one says, better call Bertolino, which is obviously referencing the Laundrie family attorney, Mr. Bertolino. The Dirty Laundries here, they've got the Laundries with the laundry basket, and then there's others. It goes kind of down the row here. But yeah, basically, the protesters got upset because over the weekend, Mr. Laundrie, Chris Laundrie, came out. He did not like the one sign that said, what if Cassie, what if it was Cassie? There was another one like this one. He didn't like that one, apparently, and he took that one and brought it inside. Now, one of those protesters is actually suing Mr. Laundrie, saying that he did not have the right to take that sign off of the swale.
It's interesting. I'm going to ask you about that in a second, but it just made me realize, if he took it inside, did he crush it up and put it in the garbage? Because ultimately, doesn't the garbage come right back out to the front street and you'd be able to see if he was throwing out the protesters' work?
Well, it's not the first time he's taken a sign inside, and we never really know where they end up. I mean, our other spot where we do live shots is actually over near his garbage cans, and he doesn't really take the garbage out very much lately, so we don't know where the signs end up, Ashley.
It's interesting. I know that the protesters were very vocal again, and this time at least one of them, she did what she wasn't supposed to do. She just went right up there and trespassed onto the lawn and did her bit. So explain what happened.
Yeah, one of the protesters went up and got very, very close to the house. We actually saw this happen last week, too, with another man that came here from out of state and was upset and went right up to their door. And then people have been putting pictures and messages on the Laundrie's car and right on their front door. Obviously, you've got sort of this core group of protesters that have been here that remain out on the street. They know the rules, but then there's sort of these outsiders that come in and get very, very close to the house.
I don't think they're supposed to be doing that without question. I think they've all been warned, and that particular protester, I think, has also been warned. I want to just play a moment, if I can, Brian, of a little Q&A with that protester and how she how she answered it and how she turned it on the Laundrie's. Have a look.
I ain't making no money off of this. They're all making money off of this. Over my sweat. I'm not making nothing. And I also made a very generous donation to the Gabby Petito Foundation. Did you? Yeah, I bet you didn't.
So, Brian, I just want to be clear. That protester says, I'm not making any money off this, but we do know that a lot of YouTubers actually are making money. So that's something that, our viewers should know about. But also that sign, you referenced it earlier on, Brian, the what if it was Cassie sign that was facing right into their windows, that they took it down. It got under their skin enough that they came and they took it down. And that has created a legal problem for them. What happened?
That has. I just want to go back for 1 second. You were talking about the protesters. Just because we're out here so much and I interact with so many of these people, there are differences. I mean, you've got the people who are out here because they are genuinely upset about what happened to Gabby Petito. You may have remembered on Friday, I interviewed that one woman who was a domestic violence survivor. Her intentions seemed very genuine coming here from Minnesota. And then there's a core group of protesters that come out here all the time, again, seem to know the rules. But you do have people who come out who clearly just want to be seen and want to get clicks on their YouTube. So there are different kinds. But yeah, back to the question about the lawsuit. Basically, there was a sign very similar to this one. What if it was Cassie? It wasn't this sign. It was a different one in a similar spot. Chris Laundrie, apparently he was bothered by that. He came out over the weekend, took the sign away, went inside. Now you've got one of the protesters who's saying, you're not allowed to take our sign. It wasn't technically on your property. I mean, that's kind of up for debate because it sort of is his property, but also sort of is the swale. And now they filed this lawsuit. Basically, Mr. Laundrie will have to be in Zoom court on December 1st to sort it all out.
So from what I gather, it's like a $40 lawsuit. Usually that qualifies you for small claims, but he has to make that appearance. He can't just sort of settle it and make it go away. It just seems odd that we're going to be seeing one of the Laundries making a court appearance in all of this, but based on $40. Doesn't that just seem ironic?
It does, and we'll see how this plays out. I mean, it's possible that it could get thrown out before that even happens. I think a lot of these people are just trying to make the Laundrie's life miserable at this point. So even if they know that it's going to get thrown out, they're just trying to sort of throw another wrench in this entire thing.
So I wanted to play some moments from 60 Minutes Australia. That's their version of 60 Minutes. They got an interview with Gabby's mom and stepdad, and it was extraordinarily heartfelt. I want to play the first part where she referred to how she wasn't so worried about Gabby going on the trip because she really thought Brian was going to protect her. Have a look.
I worried. I told her to be careful, be safe, make sure to be aware of your surroundings, don't trust everybody. But I felt safe because she was with Brian, and I felt like she would be okay. I thought he would take care of her.
How often were you in contact with Gabby while her and Brian were traveling?
I would say on average every other day or so, almost every day. She would text, she would FaceTime, send me pictures of where they were going. I loved getting the updates. I was in awe of what she was doing. It was just amazing.
That was a pretty heartfelt interview, Brian. There's a lot of reaction to the things that she said in that interview.
Yeah, and the fact that she said that she thought Brian Laundrie would take care of Gabby, I mean, that really was just heartbreaking, especially because we know how all this turned out. She went on to say in another part, that Brian Laundrie had spent time in their home, had played with her other children. It really does seem that they trusted this man.
It's amazing. All right, and then there was one more moment where she reacted. I think the way a lot of us reacted when she saw the body cam video of the police encounter in Moab, we all felt, gosh, if only we could just be there for Gabby. She was in such rough shape. And this is how her mother reacted to that and told 60 Minutes Australia. Have a look.
It's just hard to watch. I wanted to jump through the screen and rescue her. And it's a shame that it ended the way it did, but it makes me sad.
What did you see when you were watching it?
I saw a young girl that needed someone to just hug her and keep her safe. I just felt so bad for her. I wish that she reached out to me.
And Brian, maybe one of the most heartfelt moments in that interview was when Nicole and Jim Schmidt, Nicole is mom, Jim is stepdad, were asked about the time, that time period where they just couldn't get an answer from the laundries, and they were being completely ghosted by the laundries. Nicole answered that, and then she also added something that just spoke to me and broke my heart. It was what she thought of Gabby was going through the moment that she died. Have a look.
I was worried probably day 4 and 5. I started I was texting her every day anyway, but I wasn't getting responses. By day 6, 7, I was checking her social media. I didn't see any activity. And I started calling her dad, and I was talking to Jim about it. And I said, I'm worried. And everybody was like, she's fine, she's fine. They're out in the mountains, they have no signal. And I said, no, it's not like her. The night of the 11th, when the detective came to my door to let me know that the van was in Florida with him, she also said that he had obtained a lawyer. I almost fell on the ground because I was just like, where's Gabby? And that was my response to that information. And I just went into shock. I knew something was wrong. So I hope that she didn't suffer and that she wasn't in any pain.
Just hoping that at that moment,
that she was in a place that she wanted.
Unfortunately, they just cut the end of that off. I don't know if we can re-rack it. It's really important. If the control room could just tell me, if you could just re-rack that last part where unfortunately, our electronics just won't work. She said, and I think this is so important, that Nicole Schmidt said that she hoped that she wasn't suffering as she was dying, but that she instead was able to look at the beautiful mountains. And Brian, I think you saw that tweet from Gabby's dad, Joe, saying that they had planned to help her to rest in the air with that beautiful view in Teton Park.
Yeah, actually, I have to say that the first half of what you just played is what has stuck with me the most ever since I saw this interview yesterday. And I think the reason is because I spend so much time outside the laundry home. And I think some of us forget what happened when Gabby first went missing. And to hear Nicole Schmidt describe it, that she was trying to get in touch with the laundries behind me for quite some time, and that she was being ignored, and she was calling over and over again. And then to hear her say that she fell to the ground when the detective came to her door and said they finally sent police to this house, and that when they finally got inside and were able to talk to the laundries, that the only thing they would say is contact our attorney. That's information that we have known, but to hear Gabby's mom explain it that way and to think of what she was going through during that time, again, that's just the part that really got to me during that interview.
Well, just and to see Jim, his reaction as she was just about to deliver those lines, I couldn't imagine it for my children. I'm sure our viewers who are watching us right now, Brian, feel the same way. One last thing, very strange occurrence in Kent, Connecticut. A number of police vehicles and a number of other vehicles, white vans and cameras showed up at the Appalachian Trail entrance, Brian. What on earth? Kent, Connecticut is a long way away from where you are.
I think it shows that this manhunt is stretching all up and down, the East Coast, or really throughout the United States. I mean, you heard about this other guy, North Carolina, looked like Brian Laundry. They storm into his hotel room, the U.S. Marshals, with guns drawn. They handcuff him, and then they do fingerprints and realize that he's not Brian Laundry. But that, and then this example you just gave, it shows that they are taking these tips seriously. And it also makes you wonder, you know, there was this focus on the reserve. Now, apparently, they're very, very focused on other areas too.
Brian, don't go anywhere. You just mentioned that little moment about the guy being yanked. The laundry manhunt is causing a lot of problems for people who look like Brian Laundry, even guys who only kind of sort of look a little like Brian Laundry. So just imagine snoozing in your hotel bed, only to have the marshals batter in the door and drag you out as one of America's most famous fugitives. I want you to see after the break if you think the man they grabbed looks like the real Brian Laundry. That's next.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Banfield. Imagine looking like the most famous fugitive in America, Brian. Imagine the double takes that would happen, the nervous glances, the whispered conversations that would happen behind someone's back if they look like Brian Laundry. To be Brian Laundry's doppelganger would, you know, it just would not be a picnic, right? So now imagine if somebody took it to the next level and called law enforcement on you. That happened to a man named Severin Beckwith, the man on the right, an Appalachian hiker who, if you look closely, he's not bald, right? Passing resemblance, maybe because he's got a bit of a beard and a mustache. That guy was ripped from his hotel room, cuffed and fingerprinted and questioned. And he is not the only one. There have been dozens of sightings of Laundry that turned out to be innocent people. News Nation's Brian Enten has been watching this story as well. So you see the pictures. You can, I don't know, Brian, I think this is it's a tough one. Maybe he's wearing a hat. Maybe he's on the trail. I could see how this could happen. It's not so far out of the realm of possibilities.
Yeah, so we talked to the sheriff in that area. It's right near the Tennessee-North Carolina border tonight. He says that there were at least 3 to 4 specific calls reporting just this guy thinking that he was Brian Laundry. He had spent the entire day out with his girlfriend hiking on the Appalachian Trail. They go back to this small hotel that night because they don't want to camp that night. They want to be inside for the night. They're in the hotel room, according to him. The door's closed and locked, and all of a sudden, U.S. Marshals and sheriff's deputies bust inside their hotel room. They think it's Brian Laundry. They handcuff him. They have their guns drawn. They do a fingerprint check. They have to figure out exactly who he is, ID check, all of that, realize they have the wrong guy, and they let him go. But what we learned tonight from the sheriff, Ashley, was that they had done a deep investigation into this. The room was rented in the girlfriend's name and her credit card, which they apparently thought was odd. This wasn't just like they showed up at the hotel. They had been investigating the sighting for quite some time.
And I think that there was a connection with the credit card to New York, maybe even to Long Island, which was why they thought, aha. So that what you're right, they had done some work on that. It certainly doesn't make anything better for Mr. Beckwith. I mean, God, the word was is that one of the marshals had to help his girlfriend to get dressed. I mean, this is horrendous stuff. They were just having a nap. They thought they'd get a relaxing moment away from the trail, a fresh shower, some food, you know, and then this happened. So tell me about the question about his beard and what the marshals asked him to do about his beard.
So the sheriff says that it's interesting. His story and what the sheriff says happened is a little bit different. He said something about possibly having to shave his beard. The sheriff said that never happened. The sheriff also told us tonight that they banged on the door before breaking inside and they did not immediately unlock the door. So there's a bit of two stories here. But at the end of the day, they handcuffed the guy and they had their guns out.
And then hold them into the hallway or out the door. But I mean, look at those pictures. Again, the word from Mr. Beckwith is what he thinks is that he's on the trail. He might have been wearing a hat at some point. Somebody saw him and took a picture, sent that picture in. The police looked at the picture and thought there's a passing resemblance. And I think I might be able to see that, you know, especially since we haven't seen Brian Laundry in a while. He could look a little different. So there you go. There's Mr. Beckwith. And then you can see him. It looks like maybe he doesn't have hair. He does. He is just covered up. So I want to just read, Brian, a few things that Mr. Beckwith said to the New Yorker magazine, who did a feature on this and spoke with Mr. Now, listen, Mr. Beckwith is on the trail. He's out of service. We spoke with him today as well, but he said, I can't do an interview with you. I'm out there on the trail. So, but this is what he said to the New Yorker. He said, nothing, or the next thing I see is a bunch of guys with riot shields with U.S. Marshals written on them, handguns pointed at my face. And then it says, I have a notch in the upper part of my inner ear, just like his. Brian, do you remember we showed our audience that Brian Laundry had that strange notch, and clearly Mr. Beckwith either knew about it or was told about it, and maybe the marshals thought so too.
Yeah, that was another interesting part of all this. And really, at the end of the day, Mr. Beckwith seemed to have a good attitude. I know that he said when this was all over, he was sort of okay with it, and that the hotel he was staying at actually gave him like a free breakfast the next morning and another free night. So, you know, I think he's had a positive attitude about the whole thing. But I can't imagine, you know, you're in the bed at night after hiking all day and suddenly the marshals storm in.
That would just be terrifying, especially that you're having a nap and your girlfriend now needs help getting dressed. Ah, Lord. Okay, I want to continue reading some of his comments. They're really interesting. He said they had to use our hotel Wi-Fi password. That one was pretty funny. They had to use our hotel Wi-Fi password to fingerprint me because they were having trouble with their Bluetooth fingerprint thing. And then they had this little side-by-side. It was Brian and then me on the phone calling to get the shuttle. And Brian Antoinette sounds like whoever, you know, he was calling to get the shuttle to the hotel, and that's where someone spotted him. And there was some talk of a marina. So someone in the marina might have seen him on the phone with, you know, the backpack, and the Appalachian Trail is nearby, and they've probably seen the news. So does that sort of square with you? If the picture was from the marina area, that's where the person called in.
It seems like it. And again, we learned tonight there were at least three or four calls, presumably about the same guy. But that Wi-Fi comment had me thinking, because I'm just envisioning this guy is sitting there. He's been woken up. They've got this machine out for the fingerprint. It's not working because their Bluetooth isn't working. And then they had to figure out what the Wi-Fi password was for the hotel so that they could get their machine working. Meanwhile, you're sitting there the whole time basically trying to explain that you're not Brian Laundry.
And terrified, you know, all at the same time. And probably a little angry, I would think. Wow, very nice of the hotel, by the way. Like, super nice, because they didn't do it, right? So, but they gave them the free night and the free food. That's a nice thing to do. Apparently, it was a buffet. And Mr. Beckwith said that they got a whole bunch of food for the, you know, for the trail, which is nice for them. So, the other question I wanted to ask you about is some of the other people. I remember early on, Brian Enten, you said, I mean, literally within the first few days, there was a sighting in a park not far from you in Florida. A deer cam had shown a guy, but they've been dispelled. You know, all of these sightings that, you know, a fuzzy picture here and there have been dispelled. Do you know if there's any that haven't been dispelled, or if they're just keeping it all close to the vest?
They're keeping it close to the vest. Every single sighting that we have contacted police about, they said, was not proven and not confirmed, and that none of them have been confirmed. But, you know, we were sort of joking a little bit about what happened up with the guy in the hotel. But, I mean, thank goodness the police are taking these things seriously in the FBI. I mean, this is what they sort of have to do. I mean, were all the circumstances great with the hotel guy? No. I mean, the poor guy was sleeping and they barged in with guns. But, you know, this is serious, and I mean, thank goodness they are following up on the leads.
Yeah, I have to say, though, the calls that we made to the Connecticut State Police today about seeing a whole bunch of police and then vans and then also cameras, and the person who was asking the questions of the police, like, what are you doing here, waved her on and said, nothing to see here, move along, didn't want her to be there. And when we called the Kent police, they said, we don't know. Now, that to me is not the appropriate answer when there's a case like this that's this high profile.
Well, and I hope behind the scenes the FBI knows a lot more than what they're telling us. But just based on what we know today, I was thinking about what happened to this man in the hotel room. And I'm thinking, well, just on Friday, we saw all the police out at the reserve here in Florida with guns and camo acting like Brian Laundry could be there, which they later said was partly training. But then we see this sort of activity up in North Carolina, or they're going in with guns to this guy's hotel room. It really makes you wonder if they actually don't know exactly where, or, you know, what part of the country Brian Laundry really could be in.
No kidding. I mean, look at those pictures. The person who was asking the question said, these are fair questions. Like, it's the Appalachian Trailhead, and there's a bunch of cops here, like, and cameras. Like, that matters, right? But nope, the Connecticut police said, we don't know. We don't have an answer for it. It really could have looked like a movie shoot. Some of those cameras look like film cameras, so we're going to let that one slide. But Brian Enten, thank you so much again for doing all that hard work, and we're going to check in with you. Well, you tell us if you see any other protesters, and of course, we're going to be checking in with you a little bit later tomorrow. Thank you, Brian Enten.
You got it.
So coming up, okay, this guy on the run for 2 years, right? He's doing the same thing Brian Laundrie presumably is doing, avoiding detection. But he did it for 2 years. So we wanted to know what kind of mental strength it takes. And when posters like this are up, do you even know that you're one of the most wanted by the U.S. Marshals? Do you know your face is in black and white being placed, you know, all over the place? And do you have the strength or mental fortitude to keep going? We're going to talk to him. We're also going to talk to the man who wrote the book on how to catch people like him. That's next. There are movies that make it glamorous, like Catch Me If You Can, Bonnie and Clyde. But the real-life pursuit of a fugitive takes a lot more man-hours than the 90 minutes on the silver screen. And emotionally and mentally, it is draining for the hunter and for the prey. And thankfully, I have both with me tonight. Joining us now is forensic psychologist Dr. Michael Bourque. He is the former chief psychologist for the United States Marshals Service. He created the Behavior Analysis Unit for the Marshals. It was his job to help find fugitives like Brian Laundrie and Seth Ferrante. Seth spent 2 years on the run after faking his own death rather than face the consequences of going to prison for 20 years plus and having to rat out his friends for drug dealing. He was on the U.S. Marshals' top 15 most wanted list, but today he is the writer-producer of the documentary called White Boy, about a drug dealer named Rick Wersch, currently streaming on Netflix. Seth, can you identify with what Brian Laundrie might be dealing with tonight, 1 month into being a fugitive, based on your experience of 2 years?
Yeah, I can definitely identify, you know, with him. I think when I was a fugitive, the first couple months were the hardest, you know, those first couple weeks into 2-3 months. That's when you don't really know, you know, you don't really know what's going on. You know, there's a lot of paranoia. You kind of think the cops are around every corner. You know, you kind of think, you know, the cops know everything, you know, at first. You know, it takes a while to kind of, you know, ease into that lifestyle. So I believe right now he's very paranoid and really looking over his shoulder.
So if that's the case, does that last? Does the paranoia last, or do you eventually get kind of comfy in your new skin, and do you let your guard down?
No, you do let your guard down. It took me about 5 or 6 months, you know, because after 5 or 6 months, if you last that long, you kind of realize, like, you know, maybe law enforcement is not going to find me, you know, if I don't slip up, you know, if I don't, you know, give them a break, because a lot of the times that's what they're kind of looking for. They're looking for that break. They're looking for that one slip up. And then once they find it, I mean, they're going to pounce on you.
I would think, Michael Bourque, that in your, you know, business as, you know, creating basically the behavioral unit of the U.S. Marshals, that would be really important, wouldn't it? That waiting for that moment, almost letting them hang themselves, waiting for them to get comfy, or waiting for them to miss their old lives. Is that that just sounds normal to me. Does that play right?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. You should consider joining our unit at some point, because that's exactly what we do. The deputies are out there. They're constantly putting that pressure on those fugitives. So they don't, they're relentless. They don't let up at all. They are, you know, 24/7. They're out there looking for these fugitives. So it really is almost an unfair power balance, in that they're waiting for the fugitives to slip up, as Seth said, or become a bit complacent, at which time all those pressures come to bear and they make an apprehension.
So, Michael, what do you think the first mistake Brian Laundrie might make, if in fact he's on the run? Listen, there's a couple of variables, right? He could be dead, but he could just be out there. What do you think, based on what little we know of him, what might be one of his first mistakes?
You know, it's hard to say. Sometimes when we try to predict behavior like that, we're really off base, because it's the emotional ties that sometimes pull people back into their life and have them make a mistake. It's not so much the, you know, that they're need to find a place to get something to eat, or they're they're stopped by an officer for trespassing or something like that. It's wanting to attend a funeral of a loved one or attend the graduation of their adult child or, you know, something that sort of tugs at their heartstrings. And, you know, I think for Brian, you know, his world right now is in a state of chaos. His support system is gone. He doesn't have, you know, the same methods to communicate with people. He doesn't have the same ways to alleviate stress. The ways he used to deal with stress have been taken away. So as the stress increases and his coping, you know, strategies decrease, it'll be interesting to see how that manifests. And I do believe he'll make a mistake in the next few months.
So, Seth, I found it fascinating to learn that your mom would send you brownies to a mailbox, which is just astounding to me, and that you also had a chance to speak with her on the phone about once a month via payphone. I get it from where you were that would be possible, but I can understand how the authorities didn't have eyes on her to see where she was mailing these things or to see the phone calls that she was receiving. How did that slip by them?
Yeah, they actually, the U.S. Marshals visited my mom once a month, you know, at her home. And they would actually come and knock on the door, you know, and say, hey, you know, do you know where your son is? Has he contacted you? And my mom would tell them straight up. She would say, I don't know where my son is. But if I did know where my son is, I wouldn't tell you. You know, so that was kind of how it went. But, yeah, you know, it's like anything, man. You know, your parents love their kids. Like even Brian Laundrie, his parents love him. You know, so I believe, you know, they're going to help him and they're going to do whatever they can to help him stay free.
So it sounds like you have some sympathy for them because you've been in that boat. Did you deliberately keep information from your mother so that she wouldn't be complicit or you know, be, you know, exposed to harboring?
Oh, yeah. Like, I wouldn't give her my address where I'm staying or let her know exactly where I'm staying. Yeah, because I wouldn't want her to have that information, you know, because if she was in a situation, you know, where they were pressing her, I mean, if she doesn't know anything, then she can't help them.
Dr. Burke, what would you think at this point, just based on your knowledge? And again, there's little knowledge about Brian Laundrie. It's not like he has a whole bunch of friends. He was a real loner. We've not learned a lot about him, even though we've wanted to. Where would you think he would be right about now? And I'm going to give you the break to think it over. Given the fact that there are some countries we don't have extradition treaties with, which I know a lot of criminals research before they, you know, take off, not saying that he's not facing any charges, let's be clear, in relation to Gabby Petito's death. He is facing bank fraud. But I want you to let me know after the break where you think, based on your behavioral knowledge, he may have ended up or where he may be headed. Back right after this. Back now with Dr. Michael Burke and Seth Ferrante. So, Dr. Burke, I asked you before the break where you think Brian Laundrie might be now, given what you know in your behavioral analysis expertise.
Yeah, and I thought during the break, and I still don't exactly know where he is, unfortunately. I think, there's been some questions about whether he may have tried to slip across the border. And, you know, that's a lot harder than people think, particularly when you don't know the language and you don't have any support system down there, you don't have any ways to make a living. It's it really adds a whole nother layer of stress. So my suspicion, and I don't have the information that my colleagues, have that are actively working the case, but my suspicion is that he's still here in the backyard somewhere and that he's being assisted by either people who aren't aware of who he is or are in some way sympathizing with him.
Interesting you say backyard. There's a conspiracy theory that he's literally in the backyard under a planter, but I know you're referencing backyard in the United States. I only ask that because, you know, if you think about being, you know, in South America or Mexico, your dollar goes a lot farther. You can bribe people. People don't necessarily see the cable news that he's on every day here, so it'd be harder to get there and the support systems wouldn't be there, but there'd be those advantages as well. Seth, in those first 6 months, I've read that you were depressed and you were paranoid and you thought every day that you'd be arrested, that every day was your last. Is that the Rubicon you have to cross then, that the six-month mark, and then it's a little bit more smooth sailing?
Definitely. It's a mental burden that you really have to get over, you know, because when you get in a situation like that, you know, you said it earlier, your whole world just kind of, you know, caves in and falls apart. So you really kind of have to put yourself back together. And I believe, you know, in Brian's case, like, you know, he's going through it now. You know, he's hiding out. You know, he's going through that mental burden, you know, but at the same time, he's going to come to a point, you know, if he stays free, where he wants to step out, where he wants to get his life back, where he wants to live. I mean, because we're human beings and human beings like to live. So one day he's going to get to that point where he wants to live again.
Yeah. And you, by the way, you know, you were on the run at a time when social media wasn't the big, you know, the big deal that it is now. You didn't even know you were in the top 15 most wanted on the U.S. Marshals list, did you?
No, I had no idea. I mean, I definitely knew I was a fugitive, you know, but I had no idea. I mean, I was a first-time nonviolent offender for cannabis and LSD, so I still am not sure why I was top 15 most wanted fugitive, but, you know, they made me that, and they eventually caught me, you know, and I paid the price.
So, Michael, you know, Seth just said it. Eventually, you want to live again. It's been said that fugitives don't lose their humanity. And so how long can you put off humanity? If you're Brian Laundrie, how long can you actually have the mental fortitude to say, yeah, this new normal is okay. I'm good with it.
Yeah, you know, again, it's sort of easier said than done. A lot of people think, well, if I committed a crime, I'd be able to lay low. I'd be able to, you know, just sort of give up my identity and give up all my friends and family. And certainly for some, it's easier than others. But we all have that part of us, you know, the things that we enjoy, the people that we enjoy being around, the things that help us, you know, just find enjoyment in life. And when those things are gone, no one really wants to go through life just living in those doldrums. You know, people want to regain that a bit. And there again, that's sometimes where you see the guards slip. That's sometimes where you see the complacency, you know, start to emerge.
You know, it's amazing to look back, Seth, at the things that you did. You wanted to fake your death, so you piled your clothes up on a cliff with a bottle of liquor and cigarettes, and it made it look like you jumped into the water below. But what was your big mistake?
Oh yeah, my big mistake was I staged my suicide on the wrong side of the dam. So the park rangers, the U.S. park rangers, dragged the river for 2 weeks. And when they didn't find a body, they declared my suicide a hoax.
Well, you didn't think of that? You didn't think, oh, dear heavens, it's only down there that my body would get stopped up on the dam. If I go on the other side of the dam, it would be out to sea.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was a young kid. I thought I was real smart, but that was the one detail, you know, that I missed. You know, I thought, you know, I had it all together, but, you know, obviously I didn't. Sometimes as young men or young people, we think we're smarter than we really are.
And you were right around the age of Brian Laundrie. So, Dr. Burke, that's a really good point. When you do what's called, and I'm going to look at it, mapping, right? You get the characteristics of the fugitive to predict, you know, where he might be. You add the intelligence in there. It's interesting when you think about what Seth just said. He wasn't smart enough at that age to think of what side of the dam. That's got to apply in Laundrie's case too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Marshal Service and other agencies, the Bureau and other folks, there's entire teams of analysts that that go over all these things with fine-tooth combs. And I mean, they're amazing, and the connections they make, and the, you know, the temporal analyses and the geospatial analyses that they make can really shed some insight that an investigator that's just sort of tracking down leads one by one, they may not have that entire picture. And when you have a talented team of analysts, they can really draw a very interesting picture for those investigators.
So interesting. Dr. Burke and Seth Ferranti, thank you both so much for your time and for your perspectives tonight. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Coming up next, America's reluctant warrior. General Colin Powell died today at the age of 84. While his military and governmental service are well known and well documented, there was another side to Colin Powell. And boy, was it ever sweet. We're going to talk about that next. We lost a good one today. General Colin Powell, 84 years old, and no matter what side of the aisle you are sitting on right now, he was almost universally loved in some way. He died from complications of COVID-19, but was also being treated for multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer that makes it difficult to fight infection. Powell served as the 12th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was the first African-American to do so. He was also the 65th Secretary of State, and he was the first African-American to do so. And before he reached those prodigious heights, he also climbed within the command structure of the United States Armed Forces, crossing several administrations. While his military and public service is, of course, what he's best known for, there were other sides to General Powell that you might not have known about. And you might not expect from such a tough and storied leader. His sense of humor and his playful side were known to the insiders who got to see him in his less official role. And I cannot prove that to you more than by just showing you this outtake during a commercial break with Gayle King and Charlie Rose on the set of CBS This Morning. Take a look.
Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number, so call me maybe. Charlie, it was a lock. It was a lock. I didn't stop it.
Yep, that happens when you're in commercial breaks sometimes. You know, it's really important to highlight all that he did as well to improve the lives of America's children. And if you don't know about America's Promise Alliance, the foundation that bears his name, he was its founding chairman. The Alliance is a nationwide movement dedicated to America's youth and making their lives better. And as chairman, he recruited loads of celebrities with star power like, yes, that lady, Janet Jackson. What drove him to create America's Promise may have just come from his own childhood, which he described in his 1995 autobiography. Mine is the story of a black kid of no early promise from an immigrant family of limited means who was raised in the South Bronx. You know, President Biden once said of Colin Powell, he embodied the highest ideals of both warrior and diplomat. And George W. Bush had high praise for him as well. Colin Powell, someone everybody should remember. We certainly do.